From South Carolina Public Radio, this is the South Carolina Lead. I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode was recorded on April 19th, 2024, from South Carolina Public Radio Studios here in Columbia. On this episode of The Lead, we have some big news I want us to dive into.
Awesome.
First, we're looking at the latest developments in the $1.8 billion discrepancy in a state treasury account that no one knows who it belongs to. If you think it's yours, 803-563-7169, guys. Give us a call. Let us know. We also go up to Capitol Hill, where a Boeing whistleblower testified this week over safety concerns on the North Charleston-produced 787 jet. And Congress is set to vote on tens of billions of dollars in foreign aid this weekend, including for Ukraine. I talk about the Ukrainian war from a European perspective with NPR Paris correspondent Eleanor Beardsley.
Oh, my God.
Yes, we got NPR royalty in the house, folks. Tune in. The Lead loves hearing from everyone, royalty and poppers alike, I suppose. You can give us a shout. Anyone can call 803-563-7169. You can even text it if you want to, if you don't want to put your voice on. Or if you don't want to, you know, have your voice on, you can tell us that in your message. We respect your privacy. But let us know what you're thinking. 803-563-7169. Let's start off in the State House, where this week in the Senate, a disturbing report was released involving the $1.8 billion that has been sitting in an account for years. Accumulating interest, sure, but its origins are still unknown. Now, this is the latest wonky drama to come out of Columbia in recent years, but it's a big one. Some would even say boondoggle level. The discovery of the $1.8 billion came to light following the revelation last year of a $3.5 billion double-counting oversight on the state's ledger by State Comptroller General Richard Ekstrom, which led to his eventual resignation. This account, which has existed since 2016 at the Treasurer's Office, was uncovered last October, shortly after Ekstrom's replacement, Brian Gaines, was installed as interim Comptroller General. Now, this account was never made public by Treasurer Curtis Loftus. Gaines asked Republican Senator Larry Grooms and the Constitutional Subcommittee that he chairs on the Senate Finance Committee to look into the matter. Now, Loftus was recently before the subcommittee for 6 hours of testimony that grew hostile at times. But the subcommittee compiled its interim report of findings and recommendations for the $1.8 billion discrepancy in Treasury balances, and Grooms presented it on the Senate floor Tuesday.
The subcommittee finds it indefensible that Treasurer Loftus did not consider a hidden special fund containing $1.8 billion to be information pertinent and of value to the General Assembly. Treasurer Loftus remains obstinate in his claim that the fund is the responsibility of the Office of Comptroller General. However, the subcommittee finds that the $1.8 billion is held in a special fund designated to and authorized by the Office of State Treasurer, and that this fund is tied specifically to state treasury cash and investments.
So again, this is an interim report. There are still a lot of unknowns. The truth is out there, folks. They are looking for it. And this $1.8 billion that no one knows where it belongs or where it came from, well, the subcommittee says the treasurer also concealed the fact that there was a negative general fund balance on the books. That's something that's against state statute. That's against the law. That's a big issue. Now, mind you, the state treasurer does several things, but primarily the treasurer serves as the Bank of South Carolina for state government and is responsible for the safety and security, key word here, security of the Palmetto State's money. Here's Larry Grooms again.
The subcommittee understands that the state's general fund reflected a negative position of $474 million on June 30, 2023, in violation of 11.9.300 of the South Carolina Code. The subcommittee has evidence indicating that the Office of State Treasurer took deliberate steps to conceal the negative cash position. The subcommittee understands that the state's investment portfolio on June 30, 2023, reflected unrealized losses of $990 million. Despite positive bank balances and record receipts of revenue into the state's general fund. The subcommittee understands there exist in SCIS considerable discrepancies in actual bank balances compared to the reported amounts in SCIS that arose from the conversion of the Treasury's banking records in 2015. We've taken a look at the statutory provisions of the state treasurer, and we'd like to report that Section 11.5.180 of the South Carolina Code states that the state treasurer shall, at the end of every month, report to the Comptroller General an accurate statement of the cash transactions of the Treasury. He shall, at all times, when required by the Comptroller General, produce to him satisfactory statements of cash in hand and furnish him promptly with the official information duly certified relative to any matter connected with the revenue and finance of the state. The subcommittee finds, pursuant to this statute, the Comptroller General determines information that is necessary and satisfactory. The subcommittee found that on multiple occasions, the Comptroller General requested satisfactory information from the treasurer, but the treasurer would not or could not provide the information.
Now, there are some surprising revelations in this report that require even further investigation. Again, this is an interim report. But one of the most bizarre and terrifying is this account of when Treasurer Loftus was said to be moving to release hundreds of pages of sensitive state financial data, something Loftus denies, however, a paper trail confirms. Here's Grooms giving this play-by-play of what happened on April 4th.
The subcommittee met an emergency meeting in the president's office here at the State House. At that meeting were present members of the governor's staff. We had on telephone the attorney general. We had on telephone Director Marsha Adams of the Department of Administration, all trying to figure out a way how to stop the treasurer from publishing detailed financial information that would have crippled our state. The governor made a direct appeal to him by telephone, asking him to please don't do it. It was followed up by a visit of Chief Keel of SLED. The attorney general was busy drafting papers for an emergency hearing of the Supreme Court to try to have an injunction to prevent him from doing so. The governor believed at that time the treasurer was backing down. It would not publish the sensitive information. He believed that crisis was over. The governor then convened a meeting with the state treasurer on the following Monday, had some conversations with him. And then on this past Thursday, the governor convened a meeting of the treasurer and his staff, Marsha Adams with the Department of Administration, some of her staff, with the state auditor, some of his staff, and with the Comptroller General and some of his staff. At that time, he was creating what he called the working group.
What in the constitutional crisis did I just hear? You're telling me State Law Enforcement Division Chief Mark Keel was called in. Attorney General Alan Wilson was set to get an injunction from the state Supreme Court. The governor, who earlier that day was under sedation for 30 minutes for a minor knee operation, had to talk down the treasurer, which his retroactive schedule lists as a call with a constitutional officer. What? And here's even more insight. Department of Administration Director Marsha Adams, in an email to Loftus on April 4th, which is published in the report, says that after conferring with cybersecurity experts regarding information contained in the Detail Fund report, that it contains general ledger account numbers, names, fund account numbers, software details, and more, that, quote, experts warn that providing so many identifying data points would give potential hackers more ability to triangulate and map their way to improper access. They advise that a potential hacker armed with all this detail would need less additional information to convince the custodian of the funds that the hacker has a right to access the funds, quote. Again, remember, the role of the treasurer is the safety and security of the Palmetto State's money. Kind of in direct contrast there. Now, like you heard Senator Grooms say, a working group put together by the governor along with the subcommittee will continue to look into the matter and more. This is just the beginning. Grooms has called for Loftus to step down. The governor has not at this time. Loftus contends on his Facebook page that he has not read the 116-page report, which you can find on scstatehouse.gov under the Senate tab, Committees, and Finance Committee. Boop, 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 boop. Again, this report is the byproduct of the Senate Finance Constitutional Subcommittee and hours of testimony by Loftus himself. Loftus was first elected treasurer in 2010, and Ekstrom was comptroller general for 20 years. Now, of course, during that time, there had been changes made to the systems used in state government, including the South Carolina Enterprise Information System, known as SCIS, which replaced aging legacy accounting systems in the state, and it consolidated all state agency financial, procurement, and human resources and payroll records into one central system. So there's a lot of discussion about what happened during that transition and where this money came from during that time. It's also a website that the average state employee, such as myself, logs onto to file their timesheets, but of course, it does a number of other things. There were also some other big movements this week, including the stalling of the House Speaker's energy bill in the Senate, where it had been fast-tracked with just days left in session, and a kerfuffle involving judicial elections. We're going to look at all that in Tuesday's pod with the Russ McKinney and Mayon Schechter. Okay, well, enough boondoggle talk. I'm getting tired of those days. Oh, wait. No, I'm seeing in the script here that... Oh, wait, no. I'm actually being told that... Never mind, we have another boondoggle to talk about. We're going to fly up to Washington for a moment for another jarring moment. The hearing before a U.S. Senate panel over major ongoing safety concerns at the aerospace giant Boeing. We've talked often on this show about Boeing since it is one of the major manufacturers in our state. The North Charleston plant is the exclusive home of the 787 Dreamliner. But I want to give you more context about the plane before you hear from whistleblowers who testified on Wednesday, because I think you really need to understand this.
Okay, let's go.
Yeah, I'm going to.
Go ahead.
I know, I'm...
Hurry up.
You know, if you could just let me get into it.
Fine. If you need me, I'll be at my house.
How do these sound effects keep showing up? So the Dreamliner represented a major change for Boeing back in the early 2000s. Not just because it was made of strong, revolutionary composite parts of carbon fiber, graphite, and titanium rather than traditional metals, but because leadership at Boeing relied more on global suppliers for different parts of the aircraft than before. There's a great graphic online of this, but for example, the forward fuselage is made by Spirit in Wichita, Kansas, the center fuselage by Alenia in Italy, and the rear fuselage in Charleston. Wings are made in Japan by Mitsubishi, etc., etc. You know, it's a global plane. Originally, these pieces were then delivered to plants like in Everett, Washington, and then flown on down by those big Dreamlifter aircraft, if you've ever seen them flying around Charleston, to the North Charleston Final Assembly Plant, starting back in 2010 when the plant came online. However, with the third and larger model, the 787-10, all 787 work shifted to North Charleston in March 2021, hence the home of the Dreamliner. But the plane has been plagued with quality control issues for years, including fuselage joining issues that came to light in 2020, leading the Federal Aviation Administration to look into problems dating back to the start of the program. Boeing argued that its quality management system was sound enough to justify the reduction of 900 quality inspectors. By January 2021, Boeing halted 787 deliveries to complete inspection work. They briefly restarted that spring, but work was halted again amid a series of manufacturing flaws. For the better part of 2 years, deliveries had been on hold and production limited until August 2022. All that resulted in a $5.5 billion loss for Boeing. Another manufacturing problem was discovered in 2023, briefly adding to a halt in deliveries. Now, Boeing continues to make deliveries, the aircraft is certified airworthy, and there have not been any recent safety issues. But Sam Salampour, a Boeing quality engineer with over 40 years of experience who previously worked on the 787 line and was then moved to the 777 line, told senators on Wednesday that they believe it is only a matter of time till there's an incident.
I have analyzed Boeing's own data to conclude that the company is taking manufacturing shortcuts on the 787 program that may significantly reduce the airplane safety and the life cycle. Since 2013, there have been serious issues on the 787 program, not properly closing thousands of gaps in its assembly of the fuselage on major joints. Boeing's standard says that these gaps must be closed, usually by a small shim or filler called a shim when they exceed 5/1000ths of an inch. This seems very small. Boeing's PR team like to call it the width of a human hair when you are operating at 35,000 feet. Details are that the size of a human hair can be a matter of a life and death. In a rush to address its bottlenecks in production, Boeing hit problems, pushing pieces together with excessive force to make him appear that the gaps don't exist, even though they exist. The gap didn't actually go away, and this may result in premature fatigue failure. Effectively, they are putting out defective airplanes.
Boeing has said that it has made major, time-consuming changes to the manufacture of the aircraft and has not identified any safety issues. In fact, Boeing engineers have demonstrated that even by deliberately damaging a fuselage section and applying pressures greater than what is experienced in flight over tens of thousands of tests, that the carbon fiber fuselage still holds, which would not be the same for a typical metal plane. Ed Pearson, a former senior manager at Boeing's 737 factory in Renton, Washington, also testified Wednesday. He previously raised concerns to his supervisors about the dangerously unstable production environment and risks to the safety of airplanes. He says there has been no accountability following the two catastrophic 737 MAX crashes that claimed 348 lives, and that regulators are overly reliant on Boeing.
Boeing routinely states that their airplanes meet or exceed all safety standards. This is untrue and misrepresents the safety of the airplanes. The company illegally removed thousands of quality control inspections on individual airplanes without the FAA's knowledge and without the knowledge of the airlines. Although many of these inspections have been reinstated, hundreds of airplanes have left Boeing factories without those thousands of inspections. My last point is the Department of Justice and FBI relied on the slanted results of the first MAX accident investigation to develop an illegal and unjust deferred prosecution agreement. The NTSB chair reiterated to Congress last week that Boeing has said there are no records documenting the removal of the Alaska Airlines door. I'm not going to sugarcoat this. This is a criminal cover-up. Records do, in fact, exist. I know this because I've personally passed them to the FBI. A five-minute testimony is not nearly enough time to explain how insidious the story is. Boeing's corporate leaders continue to conceal the truth. They continue to mislead and deceive the public about the safety of the planes. That is the safety culture at the top of the Boeing company right now. The good news is the employees of Boeing and these agencies can overcome poor leadership. We need them to be successful. They're highly capable. They need to be supported and encouraged. And these problems are fixable, but it starts with telling the truth.
Pearson there talking about the panel blowout on the Alaska Airlines 737 MAX flight. Now, there have been management shakeups with CEO Dave Calhoun saying he will step down by the end of the year. Head of Boeing Commercial Airplanes Stan Deal is gone and has been replaced with Chief Operating Officer Stephanie Pope. And Board Chairman Lawrence Kellner, a former Continental Airlines chief, won't stand for re-election in May. And again, Boeing maintains the safety and integrity of its aircraft. Now for a global perspective on the Russian war with Ukraine that's well into its third year. The U.S. House is set to vote on a slightly different foreign aid package that's already been approved by the Senate. We'll have more on that in a moment, but I had the chance to speak with NPR Paris correspondent Eleanor Beardsley, a Columbia native. She appeared on This Week in South Carolina. She was in town, in fact, to receive an award from the USC Darla Moore School of Business, which she got her graduate degree from in 1991. I started by asking her about the war in Ukraine and being in Kharkiv when the first shots rang out, and what it's like on the continent now.
I didn't believe it until I saw it with my own eyes, because I thought, I remember telling my husband, he's not going to invade Ukraine. That would be like if he invaded Paris, you know? And I was in my bed in Kharkiv, getting ready. We'd been in the Donbass, getting ready to drive back to Kyiv the next morning. And my husband calls me from Paris and he says, where are you? Because CNN is saying that Putin is going to invade Kharkiv tonight. And I'm like, well, I'm in Kharkiv. I was like, oh my God. And then I got dressed, laid in my bed. It's like 4 a.m. I'm watching a woman walk her dog. I'm like, you know. And then I saw on my phone, Putin announces a special military operation with several news outlets. And I was like, and I look out the window and I saw the explosions. And at that moment I said, oh my God, it is going to happen. And I felt so far flung. I was like 20 miles from the Russian border. I was like, get me out of here, you know?
I was going to say, I mean, you were talking there, yeah, February 24th, you were right there on the ground more than 2 years ago, and we're still, this war is still going on the continent. What did you do in that moment? I mean, you just gave us a good little recount there, but how did you decide whether to stay or where to go, what to do? I mean, it was a very difficult time. There was, you know, hard to understand what was going on.
It was. So we, NPR actually had a plan. And we had a safe house that everybody was supposed to go to because we had correspondent in one in Odessa, some people in Kyiv. And I remember the whole time they're putting it together because I'd been in January. Nobody in Ukraine believed it would happen. You know, and then I came back in February. And I was thinking, why are they making all these plans? They had cars. So we had a plan, and it was that everyone would go to this safe house in the West. So we actually fled, and I remember we traveled with a security guy, and he was like, we need to get in the basement. And I'm thinking of all the pictures in my phone of this Lenin statue that was, like, in the mud that they... I'm like, what if the Russians see my phone? And yeah, I was just, like, freaking
You're
out.
You're thinking about everything.
Yeah, I really was, and we hadn't slept much. I'm like, no, let's get out of here, you know, that's his call, but before the highways fill up, and we did, and that's exactly what happened. We spent the whole day driving west, and the highways were filling up. People were just, like, in an absolute state of shock. I remember we'd go through little towns, and people are out in front of the town hall, like, signing up for the military. They're like, they were just stunned that this was happening. They were incensed. They couldn't believe it. But it was hard to know what was going on, and it was that first video of Volodymyr Zelensky when he said, I'm here. You know, he said, the defense minister's here. The something minister's here. I'm here. We're here. We're not leaving. And I think that made people go, whoa, we're going to stand up. And then you started hearing about what was happening. Because I remember that first day thinking, what is the Ukrainian army doing? What's going on? You just had no way to know. But then you sort of saw that they were doing stuff. They were defending. And Zelensky was not leaving. And it was huge. So, and then I've come back many times. And now, of course, we have people there. We have a bureau there. We go to the east. But that day, we had a plan. So we fled.
I'm just wondering what it's like in Europe, too, and what they think of American stance on the war. Obviously, we're not watching the coverage like y'all are, but what's the read over there?
I think they're shocked. I mean, well, I had a message from a Ukrainian friend the other day. He said, I don't understand why the U.S. talks about being behind democracy when we're the country fighting for democratic values. And they don't understand. The Ukrainians are, they don't understand it at all. And the Europeans are, like, shocked, too, but they're getting ready. They're like, what if... You know, what if that aid doesn't pass? What if Donald Trump wins and he doesn't support Ukraine? And there is a feeling in Europe that we've got to be ready to support Ukraine.
Macron was talking about not just, you know, supporting and talking tough, but also even mentioning even getting folks closer to the border, maybe NATO exercises and such, maybe even getting closer to Ukraine. And that could actually turn into something more. If you had troops in Ukraine, then there's a missile hit, and then it could spiral into something else.
Yeah, of course. I mean, when he said troops on the ground could not be ruled out, a lot of people went wild, but he did not backtrack. He stood by it. Mm-hmm. And that is what could happen. If we let this regime, this Putin regime, that is a torturous regime, that has no respect for human rights, just roll over the continent like that, I don't know where it's going to go. I mean, we fought Hitler for the same reasons. It was an autocratic, torturous regime killing people. It's kind of the same thing. I'm not comparing the two. It's not an exact comparison. But this is like a very clear fight.
And those delays in funding and equipment to Ukraine has also kind of set back the counteroffensive last year. And now we're in this tough spot with morale. But we did see on Wednesday House Speaker Mike Johnson unveiled his three-part plan for foreign aid, which mirrors the Senate package, that $95 billion foreign aid package that's been in the House for 9 weeks now. We're now just getting to it. I'm just wondering what message that might send. Now, we're talking about maybe there was this wishy-washy message from the West. Now you're seeing this actually maybe go through. Do you think that's going to make a difference?
Oh, God, yes. It's going to make a huge difference on the ground, physically. I mean, the weapons will be coming through, the munitions that they need. They don't have any ammunition. They literally cannot fight back. And also, on a morale booster, it's going to be huge. Is it going to win the war immediately? No, this is going to be long-term support because Putin is not going to give up. He doesn't care how many men he kills, and the Russians have not reacted. They're scared to, they can't even, you know, go to Alexei Navalny's funeral. Mm-hmm. So they're not about to start protesting the war. We're really in a bad situation, but if we want to see this regime, you know, we've got to do something. Otherwise, this regime will try to take over and just come more farther and farther west. It's really an existential fight for all of Europe, actually. Ukraine is fighting for Europe, and the Ukrainians are fighting for our values. It sounds like, okay, cliche, but it's actually true.
I don't want to add that we're not alone in getting this funding fight, too. There were 17.7 billion euros spent from Germany. 42.2 billion euros from America in the first 2 years of this war, but also then Macron also dedicated about $3 billion over the next decade as part of a 10-year pact with Ukraine, too. So we're not alone in this. Everyone's kind of pulling more and more of their weight.
They are, and they will be, I think so, in Europe, for sure.
I mean, are they willing to just continue spending more and more? I mean, what's the vibe? Because they used to always be a little skittish about spending too much on defense. Now it's ramping up.
Well, right, because nobody could have imagined this. This is like another world war. This is crazy. I mean, nobody imagined there would be trenches in Europe. You know, that's World War I. That's not even World War II. We're looking at tanks and trench warfare. So, you know, you can't compare it to the pre-invasion days. This is a new threat. And is there, and we're going back to these war tactics. And I think there's a feeling that, you know, if we don't take care of it now, and it is not going to be an easy fight, and we're going to have to give Ukraine every weapon they need to push the Russians back, But if we don't, I don't know what Europe is going to turn into. I don't know what it's going to be. We're going to spend a lot more, I think, down the road, and it's going to be a lot harder.
And I was going to ask you, too, when it comes to what the future looks like, when we talk about how this is going to play out over the coming years, can you even have a peace deal where Ukraine gives up part of its land to Russia to end this? Or is that just going to fester into a future war at some point down the road?
I mean, you know, people say... I mean, personally, I think Putin would only rearm and try to reattack. He would just use that time, and that's what Zelensky says. I don't know. That's up to Ukraine, we say. But I think it's just a betrayal if we you know, sit down and they give away their land. The bully comes in, destroys your house, takes your land, and you give it to him just to be in peace. And they won't be in peace because I think that Putin has not given up his dream of having Kyiv and having Odessa, which is a very far western city. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's very dangerous. You know, when you look at the Putin regime, I don't see how this can end anyway except for the end of that regime. Yeah. Honestly, there's got to be a change. But this is a huge, huge fight. And when I see people, they don't even understand the stakes. That makes me really want to, I mean, how can people say we don't have any business supporting Ukraine? That makes absolutely no sense. That would have been like saying how we have no business supporting Britain and France, you know, against the Nazis, honestly.
Our full interview is on youtube.com/South Carolina ETV. Check it out, please. But sticking with Ukraine and Washington, House Speaker Mike Johnson said Wednesday, if the vote on this aid leads to his ouster as Speaker, just nearly 6 months on the job, so be it. Remember, Johnson was just at Mar-a-Lago with former President Donald Trump last week, and Trump and his campaign are tired of a house in chaos, especially during an election year. Here is Speaker Johnson.
Listen, my philosophy is you do the right thing and you let the chips fall where they may. If I operated out of fear over a motion to vacate, I would never be able to do my job. Look, history judges us for what we do. This is a critical time right now, a critical time on the world stage. I could make a selfish decision and do something that that's different. But I'm doing here what I believe to be the right thing. I think providing lethal aid to Ukraine right now is critically important. I really do. I really do believe the intel and the briefings that we've gotten that I believe Xi and Vladimir Putin and Iran really are an axis of evil. I think they're in coordination on this. I think that Vladimir Putin would continue to march through Europe if he were allowed. I think he might go to the Balkans next. I think he might have a showdown with Poland or one of our NATO allies. To put it bluntly, I would rather send bullets to Ukraine than American boys. My son is going to begin in the Naval Academy this fall. This is a live fire exercise for me, as it is so many American families. This is not a game. It's not a joke. We can't play politics of this. We have to do the right thing. And I'm going to allow an opportunity for every single member of the House to vote their conscience and their will on this. And I think that's the way this institution is supposed to work. And I'm willing to take personal risk for that because we have to do the right thing, and history will judge us.
Bringing it to South Carolina, Congressman Ralph Norman, who sits on the House Rules Committee, which approves legislation for special order in the House, voted no on bringing the foreign aid bills to the floor, along with two other Republicans on the committee. On X, formerly known as Twitter, Norman posted, quote, "America first, always. I voted against the disingenuous rule that funds foreign wars without any border security measures for our own country. I did this for the safety and well-being of #SCO5, quote, which is the 5th congressional district that he represents. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, with the simplest, most accurate take for Republicans, said, quote, "Here's the political reality. If you think the fall of Afghanistan was bad, the fall of a European capital like Kyiv to Russian troops will be unimaginably worse. And if stalled American assistance makes that outcome possible, there's no question where the blame will land. On us," quote. Meanwhile, the war goes on and Russia continues its threats beyond the battlefield. The Financial Times report that, quote, "Bavarian police have arrested and accused two men of being Russian secret agents planning to bomb industrial and military sites in Germany to disrupt the delivery of aid to Ukraine. The two German-Russian nationals were detained in raids on Wednesday morning by police special forces in the town of Bayreuth, southeast Germany, according to the federal prosecutor's office. And in Poland, the Associated Press reports that a Polish man has been arrested on allegations of being ready to spy on behalf of Russia's military intelligence in an alleged plot to assassinate Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, Polish prosecutors said on Thursday. All the while, Moscow continues its push to sow discord in the West, including the United States. Welcome to the wind down section. It's our little break from the news. A.T. Shire, producer of the pod. We need a break from the news.
Okay,
this podcast, I'm sorry, guys, a little bit of a buzzkill.
Gavin, I told him, be more positive.
It's so hard. It's been so hard.
He's just such a...
A dour Debbie.
A dour Debbie. He's a black cloud that just floats around the inside.
That little Zoloft egg.
Yes.
Or is that the butterfly?
No, it's a Zoloft egg. Yeah, it's like
the fact that we still remember pharmaceutical icons.
Yes. Icon is the correct word, yes. And anyway, Gavin, I know that we try to avoid the news, but I have a little bit of news, okay?
It is an icon.
It's continuing, continuing series of me getting old.
Oh, yeah, so more sad news. Sad. Okay, good, good. I don't want to be too happy.
It sounds like good news, but I took the day off yesterday.
Oh.
Good news, but... But it was to work for free for my wife at Craft and Draft.
Bad news.
So I actually worked longer than my normal day of work.
Good news.
And I set up the new sound equipment at Craft and Draft in Irmo.
Is this an advertisement?
No, it isn't. And so so we're setting this stuff up and we rack up these new sound units, right? And we screwed them in, can't get them out anymore, right?
Mm.
And I had to go wire stuff up. And so I got him back, and my face was so close to the back of these things.
Yeah.
And I was trying to read all these words on it. And it was so close that I couldn't, like, I was like, what is going on? I can't focus my eyes on it. I was like, what is happening? I've never experienced this in my life. And then I was like, oh, my God. I need glasses.
But you're Mr. 2020, like myself. But, like, I mean... If you get too close, I mean,
we
can do distance, but you get too close to something, you can't really see.
I've never experienced a moment where I could not, by choice, by force, focus my eyes.
Were you this close?
It was that close, yes.
Okay, that's kind of hard.
It was like 4 inches away.
I mean, your eyes were like going macro, you know, not zoom, but macro.
I can't tell you how hard
I was
trying to focus it, and it would not go beyond fuzzy.
If you're driving, take out your cell phone right now.
My God. Yeah.
Yeah.
Give yourself an eye test right now.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
I felt terrible. I felt defeated. I felt like I was about to be 37 years old. And I added and a father.
Okay.
So that ages you. Okay.
You.
It does.
I don't feel 37.
No. Your eyes are, they may be better than mine. I don't know. I haven't been to an optometrist in like, I don't know. 8 years, you know?
Well, now that they have to do it at the DMV, everyone's like, why don't they do an eye test? It's like, is that such a bad thing, people? Don't you want to know if you have an eye deficiency?
Like, there should be prescription windshields.
Like a Jackson brother.
Do you have bad eyes?
We have that slight tinge of colorblindness.
Oh, yes, you are colorblind.
That's
one
of my few deficiencies that my mother passed along.
One and only
my
deficiency.
Father. Yeah, speaking of airplanes, Jay Jackson, Federal Aviation Administration for 41 years.
What's he doing?
He's hanging out in Charleston now.
It's gone to crap as soon as
he
leaves.
Well, that's why he's like, I got to get out of here. To be honest, though, Jay never did anything with that part of the FAA. He was a map man, you see, cartography, before he got in the podcast business for his son.
Topographic.
Well, he was a forestry major at Virginia Tech.
This man knows his trees.
He knows trees, and he's got to take down a couple.
Dendrophile, they call him.
Papa, tell me what the origin of that tree.
Yeah, over and over. My childhood was very exciting.
Yeah, I love this for you. Anyway, Gavin, if we do have any optometrists out there.
Or ophthalmologists, there's a difference.
Please,
I can't remember
let us know the difference and help me find some good
glasses.
If
you can see this, please call 803-563-7169.
I'm a defeated
man.
You
can still see normal. I mean,
yeah,
you're talking about close-up.
Fine.
Close-up's very hard.
It's that I've never not been able to focus it by force, you know?
You're coming.
I like
terms,
be like, okay, I can, there's a little bit of trouble, but I'm going to focus in here, okay? This takes it all, and it wouldn't work.
Coming to terms with your mortality.
Oh, God, it
and
was
morality.
Terrible. God, take me now. You know what I mean? Anyway.
No!
Gavin, take us to the outro, please. Thank you.
Deep sighs of sadness and eyesight fading.
If you like the sound of that, listen to the Alice Flags out the spooky, okay? Gavin does great sighs in that
one. If you like that, I'll have more poetry next week. You can help us out. Give us a call. 803-563-7169. Tell us your favorite tree. Tell us your least favorite tree. Redwoods, are they too big?
Yes.
Should we make them smaller?
Yes.
You can always leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We like that too. And again, Give us a shout, 803-563-7169. You can stay up to date with the latest news on SCETV.org and SouthCarolinaPublicRadio.org. And don't forget to support your local newspapers. For the South Carolina Lead, I'm Gavin Jackson. Be well, South Carolina. He's telling me with his eyes that he's uncomfortable.
You think I'm stupid?